All right, everyone, it's Halloween, Thursday, October 31st. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's almost muggy out there. It's wet and heavy and wet and heavy. And I keep thinking that today is such an interesting day. It's my grandson's birthday, and it's also the day that my husband died. So I keep thinking, you know, one door shuts and the other one opens. So it's important for me to remember that that's sort of the cycle of life and get with the program, Arnie. But I am going over to Redmond's birthday party today. And last year I went over as a witch, and I looked more witch than most witches, and I scared the heck out of the two little boys. So I want to go again as a witch, but I decided I'm going to be a softer, kinder, gentler witch. So I've got myself a brown witch's hat. I will wear brown as opposed to black. And then they kept telling me, Stephanie kept saying, Arnie, don't be a witch. Be a good fairy. Be a good fairy. And I'm thinking, do I have a fairy costume? This is going to kill you, Ken. I do. Oh, my God. I can't even tell you what's in my closet. It's just unbelievable, but I actually have a fairy costume. And on that note, on this October 31st, don't shop. Come shopping in my closet. I'm just telling you right now, if you are a relatively small size, you will be amazed at what's in there. You will be amazed at what's in there. And I have so much fun. I keep looking at it. It's kind of like a costume closet. It's not a wardrobe. It's a costume closet. And on that note, where are we going on this Halloween, October 31st?
Well, first, hearing you talk about your Halloween costume from last year as a witch wanting to be kinder and gentler. Mm-hmm. What about Glenda, the good witch?
That's right. That's right.
She was so sweet.
She was so sweet.
So nice.
I also preferred My Little Pretty. I like that one better. And, you know, I'm not blonde. The good witch is always blonde. I'm a brunette. Watch, I'm gray right now. But, you know, I mean, so we kind of move into the wicked witch type.
Yeah, but anyway. Your face isn't green, you know.
I can work on it, though. I put on Fiddler on the Roof fronts, and there was one scene where, remember the scene where they're dead and they're coming back to life? What is it in Fiddler on the Roof? And I had them all wearing sort of greenish makeup. Remember, I can't remember the scene. I'll think of it. You start by talking.
I was going to talk about the similarities between what's going on in Britain and what's going on in the United States because
Boris Johnson and Donald Trump.
Oddly enough.
Both have hairstyles that are terrible.
Yeah. You know, Donald Trump has a great ability to have all these twins all around the world. So he's got his friend Putin and he's got his friend Kim.
Yeah. He's got his friend Boris.
And his friend Boris. Yeah. And the two of them are both similar in that they have these outrageous positions and they just will stick to them and will brook no compromise.
Yeah.
Anybody that talks about compromise or amending or, God forbid, totally reversing their policies, they will demonize and call them traitors. And it's not just Trump who does that. Johnson has demonized the people in his own political party who don't agree with him to the extent that some of them have quit the party and some of the critics, including his brother.
Including his brother, which is, oh my God.
His own brother.
Ivanka, pay attention to this. You could walk away from Papa too. Oh, no way.
Well, yeah, or Melania.
Yeah, well, she won't. She literally made her bed.
Yeah, but he refers to arguments against the hard Brexit and the refusal to compromise. He calls it humbug. And to him, that's the same as what Trump was saying about asshole countries, you know,
they're going to have a new election as much as we do.
But they put their own parties, both Boris Johnson and Trump, put the parties in real difficult position.
Yeah.
The Tories, too, in England.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Yeah.
This guy's our leader. He's the leader of the party. He's elected as the prime minister. And yet he's acting like a crazy man and insisting on a policy that is no longer popular. And their own political chances for next year, the year after, whatever.
They didn't know what they were voting on.
With them and you're going to lose because the voters are going to think you're just a puppet and you're standing on the wrong side of history.
Right.
And if you don't support him, then he's going to take revenge and make your life very, very difficult.
Right.
It's the same thing Trump does, you know, putting up candidates in primaries that will get rid of anybody that criticizes him.
Oh, so you know what? No one has ever answered this question. Why can't the British people rethink Brexit? Most of them had no real clue at what the possible outcome was. We are able to rehabilitate legislation. So are the Brits. You can make a mistake And why can't, after they're seeing what the consequences are, which nobody quite comprehended with Ireland, with everything else, you know, what about the people that are now living in the EU that have British, you know, are from England? What happens to them after the breakup? And you look at all this stuff, and if I am allowed as a legislature to say, I screwed up, I need to change, why can't they rethink Brexit? Maybe they'll agree with it. That's fine. Give them a second shot, just the way you and I are given a second shot with legislation and the ability to amend.
And the first vote on Brexit, the people had really no information what it would entail, certainly not the ramifications. The British people care a lot about Ireland and the truce between the North and South there. And Unionists and Republicans were killing each other daily. And finally, a peace is brokered, and now this Brexit is going to maybe cause a hard border between North Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Just every time you bring some goods up there, you're going to have to stop at the border and pay a tariff.
Well, let's be honest. Growing inequality has been driving a lot of the decision-making that we're seeing now. It doesn't – I mean, and part of the problem is that in a way – you know, the EU, did it exacerbate the growing inequality? It did, because the people in power didn't recognize what the kinds of choices they were making. And there were choices that they made that benefited London and the very rich and the financial institutions and basically screwed everyone else. We, you know what, our Brexit is Donald Trump. Okay?
Yeah.
Our Brexit is that we embraced him because he was going to fix what's wrong. No, he didn't. He exacerbated what's wrong. Just the way Brexit is exacerbating what's wrong. There's legitimate anger, everyone. The anger is legitimate. The inequality is legitimate. The fact that the politicians didn't pay attention to those people is legitimate. The problem is, do you blame the EU for that or the leadership? Do you blame, you know, what happened with government per se, or the people that were governing, and that led us to Donald Trump? It's the same crap.
Exactly. That's why I brought up this article by Ishan Tarur in the Washington Post. It's a wonderful article. He not only writes very well, but he has a lot of different substance. He draws from other people's writings and scholars and examples. Again, like I said yesterday about one of our guests, it's substance and not just the usual superficial coverage of events. And
what was the title of the article at the Washington Post?
So
people can find it.
Yeah, Trump and Johnson drag their ruling parties to the edge.
Yeah, there we go.
And the author is Ishan, Ishaan, Tarur, T-H-A-R-O-O-R.
I'll grab that and post it on both my Facebook pages.
Yeah, it's terrific. And the party members are, you know, we don't usually focus on what's happening to them. We look at the people at the top and the crazy things they're doing and how horrible their lack of leadership is. But the people in the middle are getting, what do you do? Because this guy is totally going to ruin your career and call you a traitor if you disagree with him. But
that's the whole problem with impeachment for the senators.
Exactly.
Is that what they want to say is what he did was wrong, but not impeachable. He cannot tolerate what I did was wrong. It was perfect.
Right.
So he gives them no slack. No slack.
Right. And it's like Trump smearing Colonel Vindman. You know, how can you take somebody who was a decorated soldier and war hero, got a Purple Heart,
Gold Star, Schmold Star. Come on.
Yeah.
I know.
And say, gee whiz, he was born in the Ukraine, spent 2 years in the Ukraine before coming here, so he can't possibly be a real red-blooded American. And look at our immigration policy. It's just astounding.
Really? And then look what he's married to. I mean, I just want to remind you, he's married immigrants. He's married immigrants.
He brought her family over.
And before that, another immigrant. I mean, he's such a hypocrite. It's like what's good for me is only good for me and not for you. And I mean, there's nothing logical except selfishness.
And there's a growing number of these kind of rulers. Yeah. Johnson is in this article, Kim Jong-un.
It's awful. It's awful.
Orban.
Anyway, so we're going to be talking about something else today as we begin our show. Believe it or not, there are other elections going on. Are you shocked?
Other elections?
Not just the 2020. And it turns out that there are elections for governors. And as we have come to learn, leadership matters. Let me repeat that. Leadership matters. So we're going to be talking about the different governor races that are coming up in 2019 and 2020, which you need to pay attention to. And the thing I couldn't remember at the very beginning of the show from Fiddler on the Roof, where I used green makeup, was from Tevye's Dream. Remember that? Where Golda goes, Tevye, wake up. What's the matter with you? And Tevye goes, Where is she? And she goes, who are you talking about? And he's going, Fruma Sarah, the butcher's first wife. She was standing there a minute ago. And of course, I had to put that performance on, and I just thought it was so great. So that was the other time I used green makeup. It wasn't just for the witch. It was for a scene from Fiddler on the Roof. Yes. Oh, my God. All right, everyone. I will stop waxing poetic on this October 31st, this Halloween. And there was an article at U.S. News and World Report, and it was written by someone we've had on the air with us a number of times, Louis Jacobson. Louis is a senior correspondent with PolitiFact. He is also the senior author of, ready for this, The Almanac of American Politics 2020. He previously handicapped gubernatorial races and wrote for a magazine that I am going to be very unhappy no longer exists, and that's called Governing Magazine. Oh, my God, it was such an important magazine as I was a young legislator many, many decades ago. And the title of his piece was The State of Play in Gubernatorial Races. Mississippi, Louisiana, and Kentucky will choose their governors this year. See how the races are shaping up. But of course, from my vantage point, the reason why I wanted to read this is that unlike most states in the nation, Louis, you know this, there are only two states left that elect governors every 2 years. Lucky us, New Hampshire pulls the short straw, and so does the state of Vermont. And I believe the only other state, it was right around the time I was running for governor, they made the decision to go to a 4-year term for governor, was Rhode Island. So Rhode Island made the decision last. That was because my girlfriend was running in Rhode Island, which is how come I remember this little nugget of information. But it is so, I think now more than ever, what happens in the states are going to become even more and more important, in part because I think what you're seeing with the federal bench being so, you know, polluted, from my perspective, by these conservative reactionary governors, you're not going to want to turn to the federal government. That if there's going to be any kind of change that happens, it's going to happen at the state level. And even if you have a democratically controlled House and Senate like we do in the state of New Hampshire, if you don't have the governor's seat, a lot of things will not get accomplished because you never have the supermajorities that you need in order to do a veto. So with that as my sort of foundation, let's talk about what's happening in the different races. And obviously, we're not going to go through all of them, Louis, but what are some of your sort of ones that we should focus on? Because one, they're either in swing, or how they elect their governors is so interesting.
Sure. Well, obviously, the first thing to look at is when the election is held. There are three contests coming up in November.
Wow.
If you're a Democrat, these are not very friendly places to run. We got Mississippi, we got Louisiana, and we got Kentucky, three very red states.
Doesn't Louisiana have a Democratic governor right now?
It does.
Yes.
It does. And he's in a tough fight for a second term. The interesting thing is the Democrats are actually in a competitive race in each of these three states, which just going by the sort of past electoral history is pretty impressive. Let's start with Mississippi. You've got that's actually an open seat. The governor's outgoing. They've been through two rounds of primaries on the GOP side. It's only one Democratic candidate.
Mm-hmm.
They've all run pretty far to the right. In the runoff, there was a face-off between a conservative but more pragmatic candidate, and he lost out to the current lieutenant governor, his name is Tate Reeves.
Okay.
Who's quite conservative, and the question is whether the Democrat in that race can maybe get some disaffected kind of pragmatic conservatives over to his side. Challenge.
What about the black voter base in Mississippi? I mean, we keep hearing that the black voter is really the answer for the Democrats in 2020, that we need to depend on them. And I'm looking at places like Mississippi and Louisiana, and I'm going, okay, are they going to show up? Are they going to vote? Because this is a conservative Democrat that's running anyway in Mississippi. It's not like he's a liberal. So you've got a conservative Democrat running in a place where you've already seen the GOP hemorrhage a little because it was a hotly contested race. race for the in the primary. So I'm just wondering, because it's going to really be about, you know, GOTV, get out the vote. Has there been a real engagement with the black base in Mississippi? And do they have the potential to swing this election for the Democrat?
I think there has been, and turnout can definitely matter. But if I recall correctly, I think the black percentage of the population in Mississippi is like 28%, maybe 30%.
Okay.
And the like two parties are so racially polarized there in particular, not necessarily the case in other states, but certainly Mississippi it is. So I think turnout can definitely help on the margins, but, the Democrat, who's the current attorney general, he's won several terms in a row as Attorney General, is really going to have to get a significant
number of
portion of the white vote there to win. And they also have this crazy thing. I don't know if you've followed this, but they have what sort of amounts to like an electoral college.
Yeah, explain this. I just read that, and I was so, explain this to people. I'm thinking, what is this a throwback to? Tell them how you get elected governor there. That's just shocking.
Yeah, it dates back to the Jim Crow era.
No surprise.
And it's under legal challenge right now. So, you know, its state is kind of up in the air. But basically what it means is that if nobody gets a majority in the final round or the in the general election, then it gets thrown to the state house. And basically, since it's a strongly GOP legislature in Mississippi, that would give the GOP candidate an edge. Now,
Is there a three-person race? Is there a libertarian?
I think there's some minor candidates who are not going to gain very much, but it could be enough to deny a candidate a full 50%.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Now, let's go to Louisiana, because Louisiana is interesting. Louisiana currently has a Democratic governor, which may shock some people.
Correct.
Kind of curious as to how that's going to play out, because, again, I keep thinking of Landru, who is the mayor of New Orleans, who actually for a while was thought about as being a possible presidential candidate. He has really stepped up when it came to the whole issue of race. How is race going to be playing out in Louisiana?
Well, obviously, it too is a very highly polarized state in terms of race and in terms of voting patterns. Basically, 4 years ago, he's the governor, John Bel Edwards, he defeated a very heavily baggaged candidate, David Vitter, you may recall, former senator, who'd had some ties to prostitutes and so forth, and he had actually won another term of the Senate after all that had come out, but for some reason running for the Senate, for the governorship was different, and voters kind of looked back again, and his background kind of turned off a lot of people who otherwise would be in favor of his policies, and they went to Edwards, who's a very conservative Democrat, importantly, he's done things like put in place the expansion of Medicaid in the state. So he's on several key issues for Democrats. He's done some good work for their side. It was always going to be a challenging race for him to get a second term because he wouldn't have a damaged opponent necessarily, at least to the same degree. So there was a runoff. It was fairly evenly divided between the two GOP candidates. So he's facing a businessman, Eddie Rispone. The latest polls have Edwards very, very, very narrowly ahead. And this is definitely one where turnout is going to make a difference.
Now, is this businessman going to be spending his own money? Is the businessman sort of playing the Trump card, saying, I'm like Trump? You know, curious how he's packaging.
Certainly it's a state where Trump is generally pretty popular now, and so that's a plus for him to be playing that card. It's been a pretty it's been a very long campaign. They had this first round a few weeks ago, it should come down to the wire. Of the three states, I would say this is somewhat more likely to go Democratic than is Mississippi. I'd say it's a close call between Kentucky and Louisiana. where the Democrats have a better
chance. So let's go to Kentucky because it's,
yeah.
Before you do that, when you say it's more likely, but how likely does that mean? 20% chance is more likely than 10%.
So I rated
chance,
both Kentucky and Louisiana as toss-ups.
Wow.
Good.
I rated Mississippi as a lean Republican.
Okay.
And a lean Republican state is still a competitive state.
Right, right. So let's talk about Kentucky.
As okay.
Because I love Kentucky. It's the home of Moscow Mitch. And and so I think what happens, and this is important because Mitch McConnell is going to run in 2020. So he's going to be eyeballing what happens in the race for governor in Kentucky. And I want to remind everyone, I actually thought it was the governor of Rhode Island who had the dubious distinction of being the nation's most unpopular governor, but I guess I feel better that now it's a Republican governor of Kentucky as opposed to the Democratic governor of Rhode Island. So
yes,
why is Matt Bevin so unpopular?
You know, I think a lot has to do with style. Obviously, it's a very red state, and he's very conservative. You know, maybe a little bit more conservative than the state, but really not dramatically so. But it's more his personality. He doesn't get along with people very well and has just sort of made sort of had fights with folks in the legislature and other statewide offices, and it sort of burned up a lot of goodwill.
So tell me about the opposition. So what did the Democrats produce? Because I think the name I saw was a name that looked familiar to me.
Correct. It's Steve Beshear. Andy Beshear,
okay.
Whose father, Steve Beshear,
okay, that's what I thought.
Was the governor right before Bevin. So the son, Andy, has been the state attorney general for a term, and he is running strong. Bevin had a primary where he really struggled against a really no-name candidate. Mm-hmm. Beshear, among the three candidates on the Democratic side that we've talked about so far, is probably the most moderate. He's actually pro-abortion rights, as opposed to the other two, which is a problem in terms of winning over, undecided voters in solidly red states such as Kentucky.
Right.
Polls have showed this to be a very close race. My sources have told me in the last couple of weeks, Bevin has done a decent job kind of consolidating his GOP base by going, hard on the pro-Trump and the anti-abortion side.
Yeah.
So definitely plausible that the Democrat could win here just because of the unpopularity, but no easy task.
I love what one political observer you write in your piece at U.S. News and World Report. This is my favorite quote. Beshear can't win, but Bevin can lose. Yes, yes. And I'm kind of curious, how much outside money is coming into this race? Again, I want to remind everyone, it is Kentucky, that what happens here, if a Democrat wins the governor's race in Kentucky, Mitch McConnell must be gagging. Because, again, it's also sort of a precursor to what will happen in 2020. It also could mean something about what could happen at the top of the ticket. So this really is a dry run for Democrats, especially in Kentucky, because this could be a trifecta. If you win the governor's race, you send a powerful message to Trump and Mitch McConnell. You know, you better watch out. And I think why I would be curious about what happens there.
So the governor's race obviously is significant for those reasons. I would actually point to a somewhat different race, and that's the state attorney general race, where there's a sort of acolyte of Senator McConnell. He's a former staffer. He was he got some appointments as a result of his connections to Senator McConnell, and he's the GOP candidate for the state AG seat. And certainly McConnell, it appears, has done his best to sort of promote his candidacy. The Democrats have a very, actually kind of similar to the Democratic gubernatorial candidates in the other two states I was talking about, old line, sort of more blue-collar, traditional Democrat, Greg Stumbo, who actually previously served as the state AG and is now trying to get his office back. He was also a state legislative leader, too. So those two are in a really, really bitter race.
Wow.
And I would think that think it's almost as important
with the AG.
For Senator McConnell to get this AG seat.
Right, because it's personal.
Because that's really his guy.
It's really, yeah, it's very, it's personal for him. Mm-hmm. So I want to sort of touch on one thing. I mean, I know we're having a race for governor in New Hampshire, but that'll be next year. I want to talk a little bit about Phil Scott, who's running for governor again in Vermont. And I want to remind everyone, Vermont, you know, the home of Pat Leahy, the home of Bernie Sanders, has a Republican governor. But that's not surprising when you look at the state of Massachusetts that also has a Republican governor, Charlie Baker. Mm-hmm. What I think is so interesting about both Phil Scott and Charlie Baker is that location is so important, because both Phil Scott as well as Charlie Baker support the move towards at least bringing up the impeachment charge against Donald Trump. Am I correct?
Yes. GOP governors in
that was a
Democratic
Freudian
state.
Slip. It was fine.
Yeah, right. Yeah. These GOP governors in Democratic northeastern states, I also throw in Larry Hogan in the state of Maryland, have been very careful not to take on the sort of broad mass of Democratic voters in their states by taking kind of Trumpy positions. They've been the first ones in their party usually to speak out against Trump take a very moderate approach in terms of policy and not try to enact a sort of down-the-line GOP agenda.
And the only reason I'm going to bring that up is I need to let you go, but I'm going to remind everyone that we have a Republican governor named Chris Sununu, son of John. Chris Sununu, who is surrounded by Democrats. It's an entirely Democratic delegation in Washington, a Democratic House and Senate, a Democratic Executive Council. He happened to veto more of pieces of legislation than any governor in history. Probably you could add three governors together and he'd still have more vetoes. What is fascinating to me is, unlike the two governors of Massachusetts and Vermont, he is very Trumpian in not only his agenda, but his allegiance to Donald Trump, which is a little surprising given the fact, as you point out, that one of the most recent polls, Donald Trump's support in New Hampshire is only around 38%. So it will be fascinating to see his survival as he looks for a third term in 2020.
Yeah, he really, of the GOP governors in the moderate Democratic states that are up in 2020, he is definitely more vulnerable than is, say, Phil Scott in Vermont.
Exactly.
He's done a more aggressive job trying to differentiate himself from the Trump brand.
Well, I just want to remind you, if you want to know about all the illegal votes that elected Hillary Clinton and not and not the President of the United States, Donald Trump, you can point to Chris Sununu and what he said on the Howie Carr Show in Massachusetts, because he talked about the busloads of voters coming over from Massachusetts.
Exactly. I think that's on fire.
I'm sure it is way on fire. Thank you so much, Mr. Jacobson, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
All right, ciao. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, ghosts and goblins are going door to door to gather up candy. But did you know that some of that candy is made by union workers? In Hershey, Pennsylvania, tagged the sweetest place on earth, you'll find the nation's chocolate center. It wasn't always so sweet for workers, though, who in 1937 tried to win union recognition. Then the company laid off some of the union organizers, claiming it was due to seasonal cutbacks. Outraged, 600 workers began a sit-down strike in the plant. Local dairy farmers, relying on Hershey to purchase their milk, grew increasingly angry at the strikers. They joined with workers not participating in the strike and other community members. The angry mob stormed the plant to oust the strikers. 25 strikers were severely beaten, and the sit-down strike ended. But the next year, the Hershey workers tried again to form a union. This time, they affiliated with the Bakery and Confectionery Workers International Union of America and established Local 464. They are not the only union members who help make Halloween sweet. Today, Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco, and Grain Millers Union Local 1 in Chicago, Illinois makes Tootsie Rolls. If your candy of choice is Clark Bar or Thin Mints, you might want to thank the members of Local 348 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Local 125 makes Ghirardelli Chocolate in San Francisco. Unfortunately, things are not always so sweet. In September of 2016, 400 workers at the Just Born Candy Factory in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, went out on strike. The company decided to change their pensions to a 401k for new hires and reduce healthcare contributions. They make such iconic candies as Peeps, Mike and Ike's, and Hot Tamales. One strike slogan rang out, no pensions, no Peeps.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. What has leathery wings and needle-sharp teeth, feeds at night, and drinks blood? Vampire bats. Vampire bats are native to South and Central America and Mexico. They like warm, humid areas and struggle if temperatures drop below 50 degrees Fahrenheit. But winters are getting warmer as the climate changes, so the bats may move north, even going as far as Florida or southern Texas.
What people are most concerned about with vampire bats is them feeding on livestock and then passing rabies virus.
That's bat ecologist Mark Hayes. Using climate data and records of bat sightings, he worked with USDA researchers to model where the bats might show up over the next 50 years. Natural resource managers can then use those maps to identify areas where they should monitor livestock.
For example, the USDA has personnel who look at cattle that are brought together in lots, feedlots, and so forth, and evaluate them very quickly for potential vampire bat bites.
Because the threat is real, not just a spooky Halloween tale. Like Climate Connections? Subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Impeach the president. Do I love it? This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So where did you find this?
God, I don't know.
It's a song for everything.
Yeah.
Impeach the president.
Never saw that before. It's by the Honey Drippers, who I never heard of before.
I know. I thought it was
appropriate on a Today of All Days.
Of all days. Today of all days. Well, speaking of all days, it's totally appropriate that we're being joined by Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as the Dr. Politics from Iowa State. Can you hear me, Stefan?
I can hear you. Wonderful show so far.
You are like right next to me. I can't stand this. Skype is incredible. So I'm going to read you the headline from The Guardian, and I think by now the vote may have already happened, but you can tell me yes or no. Households, historic vote, passing resolution to formalize Trump impeachment process. Vote sets rules for public phase of impeachment inquiry, laying a plan that could produce televised hearings within 2 weeks. And my understanding is they're talking about having those televised hearings in prime time. Ooh, now I'll never sleep. Anyway, have they voted already, Stefan? Do you know?
I don't know.
You don't know.
I'm kind of disconnected from life a little bit, and the news comes so quickly, it's hard to keep up with it, Arnie, isn't it?
It's absolutely.
But in any case, there is going to be a new way of revealing the information about, especially the Ukrainian quid pro quo. And I think it's going to be terrific for the public. As you said weeks ago, make it public. Let people hear the testimony.
Thank you for remembering. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And the testimony, yeah, and the testimony is corroborated now. In other words, now there are people there who actually listened to and were part of the telephone conversation. Of course, the general is a Russian.
He came to the United States. He's not Russian.
Okay.
Well, anyway.
He's only Ukrainian for 2 years of his life. He left as a baby.
Yeah. He left as a three-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that incredible?
But he's also Jewish, which adds a whole other kind of icky complication to the process.
Oh, my God.
That gives new meaning to Trump saying the Jews will not replace us.
Yeah, exactly. It does.
So, you know, this is, I think people are going to watch it and understand more clearly what's going on. People don't like secret things, you know, they, even though that legally grand juries are secret for certain reasons, and the, you know, testimony, you know, before an impeachment is secret for other reasons so that witnesses can't just copy each other's testimony. But the public doesn't like it. I think the public wants to hear it. They think there's something goofy going on. And the Republicans have done a good job saying that these are secret hearings and so on. Yes. Now they're not secret anymore. Now the Republicans still don't like them.
Well, but, you know, as I keep saying, I don't want to give the Republicans an inch because they'll take a mile. And that's exactly what they did with these hearings that were not transparent.
Yes.
And I just want to remind everyone, I understand what happens with grand juries, but what do they say about grand juries? That they would indict a ham sandwich. So, and what we're finding out is that this testimony behind closed doors has been far more than a ham sandwich. It has been incredibly substantive, but it really does tell you how important that memo that came from the guy who's, you know, what am I talking about? The guy who nobody knows who it is. Is it he or she? Or
right.
The whistleblower. Thank you. That's the term of art. I couldn't remember. But now you know why the whistleblower was so important. In a lot of ways, I almost feel like this was a table that was set. And what had to happen was the first course had to be the whistleblower. Because what you have is you had a roadmap. And the whistleblower pointed to all these things that were happening. And then lo and behold, all the players in that roadmap are now coming forward. All of them. And I think they just needed someone to set the stage. Because what happened with the Mueller report was that Barr set the stage. And by Barr setting the stage, he then distorted everything we would hear because it all went through the lens of Barr's statement. And therefore, we were all disappointed. What happened with this memo that came out from the whistleblower is that it set a very different stage. It laid a level of expectation that was so dark and so wrong, and such a manipulation of process, such a manipulation of foreign policy, put people at risk, did things that were clearly outrageous when it came to the 2020 election, that I think by having that first, it really did change how people sort of engaged, and then all of a sudden, look who's showing up. And for Democrats, it's going to be fascinating because it is a group of people that they've never really trusted. They don't really trust. They've historically not trusted the deep state, as they say. And yet all of a sudden, it's these people in the military that are showing their love of country. You know, it's the people, you know, that have these credentials that historically people would roll their eyes about. And I think it's important for people to begin to sort of step back and realize, one, you can't generalize stuff on that because someone is working sort of inside the government doesn't mean by assumption that they're not supporting what ultimately is a positive outcome for the country, for its safety and its security. And they're not selling us out. In fact, they're reinsuring that we survive.
It's true, but one of the things I would add is that the average voter, and I think polls and focus groups prove this, it's not my opinion, don't really understand some of the complexities of foreign policy and how you build coalitions and why Ukraine is very important, why the United States should be providing Ukraine with better weapons so they can basically prevent Russia pushing them around. And I think, you know, that to some extent at least undermines the gravity of what this was all about, because average voters, you know, are not that concerned about it. They're not that well informed about it. So, you know, that could have an impact.
Well, and let me also say something else, is that up until Donald Trump, the Republicans were the most anti-Putin, anti-Russia group of people on the planet. Because there's now this love affair between Putin, because we refer to Moscow Mitch as opposed to Mitch McConnell, because there seems to be this incredible symbiotic relationship between Russia and the current administration, it is hard for Republicans to see this as offensive. Because what are the Ukrainians afraid of? Russia? We like Russia. I mean, look at his relationship with Russia. So in a lot of ways, up is down, black is white. That's part of the problem. It's not even that you don't understand. It's that the base of the GOP has changed. One, because maybe historically they didn't understand and they were always swayed by whoever the leadership was. But the leadership now is Donald Trump, who defends Putin before he defends anyone else.
Yeah, it's I'll tell you, it's pretzel shaped. You know, you start here and you think you're going one direction and it curves around and then curves again. Yeah. My students, by the way, we had a good discussion at one point, and they said, well, you know, the Cold War ended.
I know.
And we were really happy that it ended. And we helped Russia basically become Russia and the Soviet Union disintegrate, because we really supported all of the republics of the Soviet Union taking off and becoming independent countries. And so Russia was not our enemy. We were happy that we would have new relations with Russia. And so why all of a sudden are we saying that, you know, Russia and Putin are so bad? And I have to explain it to them. But
right.
It's confusing. It's
right.
confusing because
they don't know Putin's history. Putin is still angry.
Well, they don't know Putin's history, right.
Right, exactly.
But they do know, you know, because they've taken a course from one of our other great professors who teaches, you know, Russia or post-Soviet politics.
Right.
And one of the students even said to me, you know, we actually... He heard that in a Russian history class or Soviet class, that we worked very hard to undermine the Soviet Union with the Voice of America,
right,
with
right.
the Democracy Institute
right.
in Washington, D.C.,
right, right.
and we did cause the Soviet Union to fall apart. And so she said, it was a woman, she said, you know, now we're upset that Putin is messing around in all these other countries, but... You know, we really caused the Soviet Union to disappear, didn't we? And I had to sort of reluctantly say, yeah, you know, we did.
It's so interesting.
You see?
Winning and losing. We forget, you know, we don't even forget why we fought or why this was happening and why Ronald Reagan did what he did. And what was the fear of the Soviet Union and the idea that if it was no longer the Soviet Union and was Russia, it would create greater stability as opposed
right.
to having our military weapons and our atomic weapons aimed at each other. I mean, which
right.
is what they don't know that, which is why I think really what
yes.
needs to happen now is that if you're going to be taking a course on Russian history and Soviet history, there should almost be a separate course on Putin. Just
yeah,
on Putin.
Yeah.
No. I'm
yeah.
serious about this.
Sure.
I think it's really important to understand that leadership matters. Now, you're going back to a history lesson, but unless you understand what the players are and what is their raison d'etre, you may not understand. He doesn't want to be the head of Russia. He wants to be the head of the Soviet Union. And that's
yes.
what he's trying to reclaim. And Donald Trump, to a large extent, is trying to help him.
Well, and let's put it this way. In Russia, it's somewhat popular, you know, to get back the dignity
the
that they lost and
right.
blah, blah, blah. You know, nationalism and patriotism, which are not the same thing but are similar, can be a very powerful tool to raise people's sort of enthusiasm for you and, of course, their country. So,
right.
You know, and we thought that Russia was going to become a democratic country with free elections, and
never quite happened.
And they didn't. You know,
yeah.
they sort of stagnated,
right.
and turned into an autocracy that's actually very dependent on oil. You know, which is their major resource.
And of course, they must be really threatened now by climate change, because there's more and more people are going to be moving away from their only resource that provides any kind of income, because they have no economy. No economy.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
people have no idea that but for the oil,
yeah.
they would basically be like, you know, they would produce as much as Alabama. You know, it's kind of shocking to people.
But also natural gas. You know,
yeah.
they're a huge provider of natural gas to, I have a lot of relatives in Germany, and we talked about that the last time
right.
I was there, that, you know, their stove, their gas furnace and other things, they said, you know, that's Russian. That
yeah.
stuff comes in a pipeline.
Right.
And so I think we have to remember, Arnie, that the end of carbon-based energy, that's not this week, next week. It's not
right.
even this decade.
Right.
It's so far away that, you know, if you've got oil or natural gas, you're going to be selling that stuff for a long time. And what's going to happen is, and this is a sad story, I hate to disappoint you, as the, you know, as it reduces in availability, the price will go up. So we've got a
yeah.
huge battle and a huge struggle ahead of us. We really do.
So I want to talk about two things, but they're very
okay.
related. And
okay.
we were talking about this just before I came on the air with Ken, and that is the two decisions. The decision by Twitter, no political ads,
yeah.
and the decision
yeah.
by Facebook, I'm not going to fact check the political
yeah.
ads. And I'm
yeah.
trying to figure out which one's right, Which one's wrong? And is there an answer in between? And I was awake at 3 a.m. this morning, so that tells you how well I don't sleep. And I heard this conversation on CNN. And the conversation was about exactly this topic. And one of the men said something very interesting. What he said was he thought that Twitter was wrong and that Facebook was wrong, that they should run political ads, but they should do what the media is required to do, which is to fact check. And as I was listening to that answer, I actually yelled at the TV. And I said, really? How do you determine what is the fact?
No.
When it comes to
that's right, Arnie.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult. So if it is a promise I know I can't accomplish, a lie? Or is it a – I mean, what? How do you set the parameters for what is true and what is fiction when it comes to political ads? It's terrifying.
And let me tell you right now, I was researching this today because I thought it might come up. So it's coming up now because I'm mentioning it.
Right.
Is the American economy right now doing really well, or is the American economy slowing down and beginning to sputter?
Right.
You know what? If you ran an ad saying the economy is doing really well, you would be right, because the Council of Economic Advisors put out a report that I read this morning, and it shows that the economy is growing a little slower than we thought, but it's consistent. It's the longest expansion in American history. The number of jobs created is enormous. Consumer confidence is still pretty good. Then you know what happened to me. I went to Roll Call, which is a publication that I love, and John Bennett had an article that said, often talkative Trump goes quiet amid impeachment testimony and slowing economy. And I went, what?
I just read an article that said
the economy is growing.
Right.
And Bennett goes on to point out that it is slowing. It may be growing, but that there are potential problems. So if you run an ad that says, the economy is slowing down and we need to, you know, dump Trump and reelect a Democrat again because the economy is slowing, and you're fact-checking that at Facebook or Twitter, which of the two arguments do you then go with?
You say, no, this is a lie,
because I just read an article by Bennett that says the economy is slowing. So it's just impossible.
So
newspapers do it, though. Newspapers try very hard.
But again, there is no perfection here. And I think I'm going to be honest with you. As I was thinking about this more and more, I think I'm more in the Twitter camp than the Facebook camp. I would rather – Facebook is not going to make that much money from these political ads anyway. Twitter was only going to make a couple of million. So for them, it was not a heavy lift, and nobody really reads Twitter except for Donald Trump and his followers. But Facebook is very powerful. Facebook is very powerful and has a much, much bigger following. And the idea that you're going to run political ads and not fact check them, I think is a convenient response, but I think it's a wrong response given the fact that it is so universal. You know, it is so huge that in a lot of ways, if you want to know who's delivering all the dark and mysterious, you know, fact-free news, you can point to Facebook, and now they're going to do fact-free ads.
You're depressing me, Arnie. Stop it. Let me tell you something, though, Arnie. I have a Facebook account, okay? And if I post something there that says, it looks like the economy is slowing down, this could be a really big problem for Donald Trump. Is that a political ad? Is that just a comment? If I say probably Biden might be able to do some things that would improve the – I mean, you don't have to run strictly political ads. They can be, you can put things in there that are not ads, that are just posts.
I don't disagree with you.
And you can't stem – It's like a balloon. You can squeeze one end of it and it'll pop out somewhere else.
So the other thing is, I want to also talk to you, for example, about the economy story.
Okay.
What is it? Is it true or is it not true? Is the economy roaring, doing incredibly well? You just pointed to what you read and then you pointed to the article in Roll Call.
Yeah.
So one of the things I think people need to remember is that the how you define how well the economy is doing is defined by the size of your lens. So if you just look at the lens of what the numbers are that the Council of Economic Advisors is looking at, then we are doing well. If you expand the lens and you begin to look at what's happening in Hong Kong and you begin to look what's happening in the UK and you begin to look at what's happening in the tariff wars and you begin to look at climate change and you begin to look at all those things, and then you look at the deficit, if you expand the lens – then guess what? Given an expansive lens, guess what? The economy ain't doing so well. Part of the problem is that Trump and the Republicans are very xenophobic. You know, it's all about making America great again. It's about bringing us all back as if we're an economic island unto ourselves, which you and I know is bull. And the problem is that then you have to go into this definitional thing, which is why you're right. I can post misinformation and get slapped down on my personal Facebook page. But when you are planting ads, and those ads can be everywhere. So every time I open up my Facebook page, I don't see my space. I see your ad. That's the difference between an ad that is a lie and what I post on my Facebook page that is a lie. One is pervasive, omnipresent. The other is not. That's one of the reasons why I think that maybe Facebook should really embrace what Twitter did.
Well, the other difference, though, if I may, is that there's a difference between truth being seen from different points of view or different sized lenses,
exactly.
Like the economy.
Exactly.
You know, how the economy is doing is kind of a complicated question.
Right.
But at least there ought to be some way to criticize or prohibit blatant lies. Things like saying,
look what AOC did,
like
with
you said,
Zuckerberg.
Up is down or black is white.
Right.
Like Trump says all the time, you know, things that are just blatantly not true.
And that's why I think that an ad is different from what I post on my Facebook page. I'm sorry, Stefan, it's not the same. If you are wealthy enough and you can place enough ads, they show up 24/7. They show up every time I click on. And that is very different from someone having to find my Facebook page, actually read it, and actually decide whether it's true or not. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there's a difference in its heft and its availability.
Yeah, a subtle difference. Yeah, but here's the deal. Remember, the Russians didn't run political ads. What they ran was all kinds of Facebook trolling operations, which had the same effect as political ads. And so that is really hard, and Facebook is trying to take down the websites that clearly they see are connected to groups that have nefarious or, you know, Russian and other connections. But let me put it this way. 1 billion people are active Facebook users.
It's incredible.
100 million use Instagram at least once a month. How are you going to monitor a billion Facebook sites where people may be posting every day? It's just a monumental challenge. And, you know, I think we haven't figured out yet, you know, how to deal with this. I really don't.
So I have to ask a 2020 question. You're from Iowa, Iowa State, professor of political science, and I'm from New Hampshire. So the new polls that are out, Bernie is winning in New Hampshire. So Bernie has really sort of changed the landscape again, despite his heart attack. What we actually realize is that I think Elizabeth Warren didn't realize how much she wounded herself by not answering the question on how she would pay for Medicare for all. But the real story is Biden. What about Biden and Iowa? So if you were a betting man right now, does Biden win Iowa? Or, as I suspect, Biden loses Iowa and New Hampshire?
Yep.
No, Biden is not doing very well in Iowa.
What's his message?
You know. Biden's message? His message is, gee, I'm not raising enough money. Please send money.
Yeah, I thought his message was, remember Barack Obama. Remember Barack Obama.
Yes, that's the other message.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Means what's his message to try to win other people to support him, win over voters?
Well, his message is pretty simple, and that is, you know, I'm not as liberal as some of the others. And, you know, he's not doing that well in Iowa with that particular you know, theme. So I think I sent you an Iowa State University poll that we do. And in that poll, geez, Mayor Pete is second after Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting.
And Bernie Sanders. And then after that, Biden.
Well,
you know, that's astonishing, I think.
Well, and the other thing is that I keep thinking about Donald Trump, where his slogan is Make America Great Again. And I feel like Biden's slogan is Make America Obama Again. And the idea of going back, and I think there's a sense of frustration, especially with the Democratic base, that the question is about how quickly we want to go forward. But the idea that we want to go back is not selling. Even if you love Barack Obama, even if you love, you know, his eloquence and his stability, and all those things, there are things you're still disappointed in. Mm-hmm. The fact that, you know, he bailed out Wall Street and forgot about you. The fact that he was not able to get a public option with the Affordable Care Act. The fact that he was not able to move forward really quickly on issues like climate change. There are a lot of things that you still see. And you realize that he may have been okay for the time, but the times have so dramatically changed. I mean, the story of California is the story of climate change that we thought was going to be a conversation. We're going to have a crisis of 2030, and the crisis is tomorrow.
And it's monumental.
It's monumental.
It is. It's just somebody had 70 mile an hour winds. I watched one of the cable networks, and the firemen were being blown over by the wind.
By the wind.
And trucks were being blown over on the road.
Semi trucks are being blown over on the road.
God.
Understand that, and then put a flicker of a fire with that, and you can't even imagine how much it shows. There, I mentioned this before, and I'll mention it again. There's an amazing opinion piece at the New York Times from I believe it was the other day about how this man just basically said, I can't live here anymore, and I love California like you can. And his sense of being heartbroken and his sense of fear and the ideas. And of all the places, one would have thought that California was the most prepared to deal with some of these issues that, looked at issues of sustainability, that looked at issues of climate change, that looked at issues. I mean, look what they did with the car industry. And yet it turned out it wasn't enough. It wasn't even close to being enough.
Arnie, don't mess with Mother Nature.
I know.
You can't do anything to overcome fire, wind, or water.
Exactly.
It is so powerful. When you think about a storm surge, when it slams into a house, it's like a bulldozer.
Exactly.
And, there's almost nothing you can do. And so climate change is far in the future.
And yet
reducing the carbon footprint and all that is going to take a long, long time. And California is right now in huge trouble. It can't wait that long. They've got to come up with other solutions.
Can I just say that I'm so glad that you're talking about California now, because I had anticipated that you would, and the song I chose to go out with is that Warm California Sun by the Rivieras, because I remember from the 60s growing up and people
the allure of California.
California is so wonderful and sunny, now look at it. The sun is scorching the place and
terrible. Thank you, Stefan Schmidt, so much. Professor of political science from Iowa State, thank you again. We're going to end with California Sun. Here we go.
Short and the nights are long. Where they walk, and I walk. They twist, and I'll twist. They shimmy, and I'll shimmy. They fly, and I'll fly. Well, they're out there having fun in that warm California sun. Well, I'm going out west, out on the coast, where the California girls are really the most.